Thank you, Barry, for those kind words, and thank you so much for your presence this afternoon. I want to extend a deep appreciation to the elders of this fine congregation, to every member. I'm just thrilled to be here, and I appreciate so much the kindness that this congregation has extended to me. It's been a joy to be here, and I appreciate so much the gracious invitation to be in your presence. I love and appreciate every member of this congregation. Appreciate the great work these two fine individuals to my right to do every time they are able to tape lessons and all the work they do. You're just a genuine delight to see, and I appreciate y'all so much for the great work y'all do. And thanks again for letting me to be here in your presence. The difficult task set before me is trying to cram 56 pages of manuscript material into 37 minutes of time. And so what I plan to do is to fast forward through much of the material that is found in the first half of the book and really spend three specific observations in the two sessions that have been allotted to me. In the first place, I want to look at the biblical concept of adversity as it is seen in the world in which Job found himself. In the second session, I want to look at the biblical concept of adversity as it is depicted in the book of Hebrews. And then if time permits, I want to close out by looking at some lessons that we can learn from adversity. Now, I think there are various reasons that could be given as to why individuals suffer today. In the first place, some individuals suffer because of the personal wrong choices they make. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man sows, that shall he also reap. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. The divine principle of sowing and reaping simply cannot be altered by any human being. Some individuals suffer simply because of the personal wrong choices that other individuals make. In Romans 5 and verse 12, wherefore as by one man sinned, and sin entered the world. And so we recognize that individuals sometimes suffer as a result of the transgressions of other individuals. And really closely associated with that second one is this. Some individuals suffer because of the sins of former generations gone by. In Lamentations chapter 5 and verse 7, the Bible says, our fathers have sinned and are not, that is, they're no longer with us, and we have carried their iniquities. That simply means that they carried the consequences of their father's transgressions and sins. But ladies and gentlemen, when individuals suffer for no apparent reason from an earthly point of view, that presents an enormous challenge to one's faith. Welcome to Job's world. You see, most of us will recognize that life is difficult. Life is punctuated with headaches and heartaches. Nobody would dispute that. But when individuals suffer for no apparent reason from an earthly perspective, that's a horse of a different color. And that is exactly the world in which Job found himself. I love how Eugene Peterson describes this in his introduction to the book of Job. He writes this, listen, he says, it is not only because Job suffered that he is important to us. It is because he suffered in the same ways that we suffer, in the vital areas of family, personal health, and material things. Job is also important to us because he searchingly questioned and boldly protested his suffering. Indeed, he went to the top with his questions. It is not the suffering that troubles us. It is undeserved suffering. Almost all of us in our years of growing up have the experience of disobeying our parents and getting punished for it. When that discipline was connected with wrongdoing, it had a certain sense of justice to it. When we do wrong, we get punished. One of the surprises as we get older, however, is that we come to see that there is no real correlation between the amount of wrong we commit and the amount of pain we experience. An even larger surprise is that very often there is something quite the opposite. We do right and get knocked down. We do the best we are capable of doing, and just as we are reaching out to receive our reward, we are hit from the blind side and sent reeling. You know, before we begin our journey into Job's world, some preliminary thoughts I believe are very important as we think about the overall concept of this book, because a failure to recognize the concept, the purpose of what Job is all about, I believe is the principal reason why so many individuals have so much difficulty with regard to this subject we're talking about. It is very important for us to recognize in the first place that the book of Job is not about Job, it is a book about God. God is the central character in all 66 books of the Bible, and never do we see this more clearly in the book of Job. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. It was God who first met with Satan and struck the deal regarding Job. It was, number two, God who released Satan to go after Job. Number three, it was God who set the boundaries, placing limitations on each attack. Number four, it was God who permitted all of it to happen, start to finish. Number five, it was God who finally broke the silence and spoke to Job. And number six, it was God who finally set the record straight, rebuking those sorry counselors and rewarding his faithful servant. This book is a book about God, and it extols the majesty and supremacy of Jehovah God in a very fascinating way. While it is true that Job plays a vital character in the book, he is just that. He is simply merely on stage, as it were, while this great heavenly contest is taking place between God and Satan in the heavens. Now notice in the second place that the book of Job does not answer the question of why do bad things happen to good people. You know, if someone had asked me when I first started preaching what the book of Job was about, I would say, well, that's easy. The book of Job is the most comprehensive, detailed discussion about human suffering in the Bible. Far from it. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it's amazing to see that God did not answer a single question that Job asked with regard to human suffering. Not one. He bypassed all of that. And so if you're looking for an answer to the why question surrounding the issue of suffering, you're going to come away disappointed in the book of Job. It's very important for us to recognize that God declined to answer and explain the question of why, and he has every right to do so. God does not have to walk into a hospital and tell a grief-stricken family, all right, here are five reasons why this happened to your son. And yet that is the kind of God that most people want. A God that will just come right out and explain to us why they are going through certain difficulties. That's the God that people want. You know, Jesus likewise avoided the issue of cause when it came to suffering. In John chapter 9, when his disciples drew certain conclusions about the man that was born blind, Jesus politely rebuked them. In Luke chapter 13, you recall the similar instance there occurred where certain individuals drew wrong conclusions about two catastrophes that claimed the lives of a host of innocent people. Jesus declined to answer the cause behind that, but he made it very important that those individuals didn't do anything unusual to deserve their fate. But he took the opportunity to take those two tragedies and teach a very critical lesson, and that is this. The bystanders of catastrophe have just as much to learn as the victims themselves. That's the lesson. And basically what he was saying was this. The brevity of life beckons both the bystander and the victim to repent before an unfortunate circumstance comes into our lives. It's exactly what he's talking about in Luke 13, 1 through 5. The point is this, ladies and gentlemen, from the biblical evidence, trying to find a hard and fast answer to the question of why is simply out of bounds for the Christian. You know, I love this comment that this individual wrote. Listen to what he said. He said, whenever you take on one of God's prerogatives, we tread on dangerous ground. Even a well-meaning attempt to comfort a child, God took your dad home because he liked him so much, crosses over into an area that the Bible seems to rule out of bounds. Don't miss that. Though catastrophes, an airplane crash, a plague, a sniper's random killings, the deliberate poisoning of medicines, a famine in Africa, cry out for some authoritative interpretation, the book of Job offers an important reminder, God himself did not attempt an explanation. Third, Job is the Bible's prime case study of disappointment with God. Nobody can read the book of Job, especially the third chapter, and not see a man reeling in disappointment. Some years ago, Harold Kushner wrote a book entitled, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. The book of Job raises the ante. It portrays the very worst possible things happening to the very best of people. It's exactly what the book of Job depicts. You know, Job's disappointments are only increased when you consider the fact that God is not speaking to him. The heavens are silent. Now, think about this, ladies and gentlemen. As a patriarch, he was used to God speaking to him on a regular basis. But now, in a time when he is in profound misery, the heavens are silent. He's not receiving any word from God. God finally speaks at the end of the book, and when he does not answer a single question that Job raised, not one. You talk about disappointment. No wonder he was disappointed in the book. I think it's important for us to recognize that in order to get the full emotional impact of Job's plight, I went back and reread his speeches over and over and over again, trying to figure out what was the single thing that occupied his thoughts more than anything else. I agree with one writer's summation who said this. Listen to this. He said, I expected to find him complaining about his miserable health and lamenting the loss of his children and fortune, But to my surprise, Job had relatively little to say about those matters. He focused instead on the single theme of God's absence. That's it. What hurt Job most was the sense of crying out in desperation and getting no response. Remember, Job knew nothing about that contest that was taking place between God and Satan. You and I know about it because we read it, but he had no idea what was taking place in the heavens. You and I know because we have the story right before us. He did not have that, folks. I think most of us recognize that when we find in life that when we don't know why we are suffering, the suffering is much harder. For Job, not knowing why was the most difficult part for him. That really should bring us to number four. That is this. The book of Job should nail a coffin lid over this idea that every time we suffer, God is punishing us or trying to get our attention. You know, Job's three friends evidently were convinced of that. Job 4:7. They convinced that sin was, or all suffering was a result of personal sin. And in the book, they try to discover the secret sin that he was hiding in his life. Quote, hiding. He wasn't hiding anything, but they tried to discover what that particular sin was. This concept is still prevalent today. Luke 13:1 through 5 and also John 9 make that quite clear. But even today on television, there are certain television programs entitled such as The Wrath of God on the Weather Channel. Anybody ever seen that? What does that program depict? Natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, and the devastation they bring to our society. The point is clear. God is punishing us by these things. But the book of Job teaches us that a person can suffer in the absence of personal sin. Number five, the book of Job is not about one man's suffering as much as it is about one man's faith. I wish people could learn this principle right here. If we focus primarily on chapter 3 onward, we miss the central theme of the book. You see, folks, the plot is found in chapter 1. And when you read the prologue, the book seems clear to us as far as what's taking place. The very best man is undergoing a severe crisis of faith because of these things in his life. The book of Job is not so much about human suffering as it is about faith. And one man's faith made a difference, a huge difference. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever thought about the fact that God must have had a tremendous amount of confidence in this one man, Job, because his entire reputation was riding on the response of a single human being. That, to me, is one of the most profound, grandest lessons you'll ever find in the book right there. That the faith of a single person matters to God. His entire reputation was riding on that response. You ever thought about that? I think that is extremely important for us to recognize. Your faith and mine matters to God. The way you and I respond to adversity matters to God. Now, the book of Job opens with a remarkable resume of a fine man. In Job chapter 1, beginning at verse 1, the Bible says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and avoided evil." In verse 2, his family is described for us there. By the time Job's story gets told, all 10 of his children are grown. Things are going so well for his wife and him. To them, life was at its zenith. Things are going marvelous for them. We learn in chapter 5 that he had a tremendous amount of concern over the spiritual welfare of his children. Verse 3 tells us that he had amassed a remarkable number of possessions. Things are just wonderful for Job and his wife at this time. But the back of his resume tells the rest of his story. In a quick and brutal sweep of back-to-back calamities, Job is reduced to a twisted mass of brokenness and grief. One man describes it like this, quote, "The extraordinary accumulation of disasters that hit him would have been enough to finish off any one of us living today." Alexander White, in his book, Bible Characters, writes this, quote, "Job's sorrows came not in a single spy, but in battalions." I like that. And so Job is left bankrupt. He's left homeless, he's left helpless and childless. He's left standing beside the 10 fresh graves of his dead children on a windswept hill. Remember, folks, he has no idea why any of this is happening. He has no idea. One writer captures the scene in these words, quote, "Job lost all of his precious children in a freak storm out of nowhere for no apparent reason. And for the first time in 35, maybe 40 years, Job and his wife are childless. Furthermore, God hid from that father and mother the meaning of this confusing quagmire. He provided no explanation, offered no comfort. The silence of heaven became more devastating than the shocking news on earth. Remember, Job has no idea why all this is happening. All he knows is that one day everything is going great, and the next day everything is gone. Everything. Does this book speak to you and me today, or is it just something that's archaic? We'll make the application here in a few moments. Job's reaction to all of this is remarkable in verse 20. Look at what it says. I love this. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Well, scene one closes. God's prediction of his servant Job would prove to hold true. He did not curse God as Satan sneeringly predicted that he would. That brings us to scene two. Because as chapter two opens up, we see that Satan has come along the scene again in the heavens to appear before God. And you remember what happens? Basically, that they have another conversation. God describes the marvelous character of Job in the opening verses there, but then gives a divine permission slip for Job to do whatever he wants to this, or to Satan, to do whatever he wants to Job. Look at Job 2 and verse 6. "And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life." Imagine your name being connected to such an agreement. Can you imagine that? Verse 7, he leaves immediately. "So went forth Satan from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." Warren Wiersbe is not a member of the church, but he describes the scene here that you just read in these words, quote, "There the city garbage dump was deposited and burned, and there the city's rejects lived, begging alms from whomever passed by. At the ash heap, dogs fought over something to eat, and the city's dung was brought and burned. The city's leading citizen was now living in abject poverty and shame. All that he humanly had left were his wife and three friends, and even they turned against him." Ladies and gentlemen, you are looking at a man who is the personification of misery. If Job were in a hospital today, he would have a no visitor sign hanging on the door. You know, I recently read a story of a man who, of unwavering faith, who was studying the book of Job throughout many weeks, many months of study. He phoned a friend to tell him just how enriching the study had been to his life, and his friend rather pointedly said to him, "Be careful, Tom, because you may become the main character of the book before your study is through." That's profound. Do not think that this individual standing before you did not think about that when I was preparing this manuscript. You may become the main character of this book before your study is through. Does that happen to folks? Most assuredly. Now, what about what Job teaches us about adversity? Remember, the book of Job does not fully settle the question of human suffering, but it does at least give us some insight into how to respond to adversity. I find no less than seven things in this remarkable book, the first two chapters, that Job teaches us about adversity. Number one, listen to this. In the first place, a vertical relationship with God will keep us from horizontal panic. That's chapter 1 and verse 1. We've read it a moment ago. Job was upright, talking about his relationship with God. He avoided evil. He was a man of unparalleled piety, very religious man, just like Cornelius was in Acts 10. And so this individual, nothing is going to cause this man to panic on a horizontal level. Nothing at all. Even his response in verses 20 and 21, as we mentioned a moment ago, this man at this point is not going to be moved at all. You see, a vertical relationship with God will keep us from horizontal panic. Dr. Francis Anderson, a medical doctor and author, perhaps wrote one of the finest pieces I've ever read on this particular point right here. Listen to what he says. He says, "Job finds nothing wrong with what has happened to him. It is equally right for God to give gifts and to retrieve them." That's round one. "It is equally right for God to send good or adversity." Round two. And he goes on to say, based upon what Job said to his wife in verse 10 of 2, "Receive is a good active word, implying cooperation with providence, not mere submission. Such positive faith is the magic stone that transmutes all to gold. For when the bad as well as the good is received at the hand of God, Every experience of life becomes an occasion of blessing, but the cost is high. Now listen, it is easier to lower your view of God than to raise your faith to such a height. How true that is. I mean, when things are going well, how great our concept of God is. But ladies and gentlemen, let your health take a nosedive. Let a calamity come into your life, such as the loss of a loved one or a financial crunch, and how quickly our attitude changes about that same God. You see, it's easier for us to lower our view of God than to raise our faith to such a height. You talk about a remarkable man here we're talking about. You see, it's easy to question God when hard times replace good times. But when adversity strikes, a strong vertical perspective will keep our faith vibrant and balanced. Number two, in times of great adversity, clear discernment is needed to detect wrong advice from well-meaning people. Now, when Job's wife had enough, in verse 9, she said, "Curse God and die." Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Since when did suicide eliminate all problems? Job knew that he had a God that he one day would stand before, a fact he himself affirmed in Job 19, 25 and 26. I think it's very interesting to analyze the significance of her statement here, because sometimes we just read the statement and go on. But think about this, folks. What she said is extremely critical in the overall theme of this book. Number one, she unknowingly questioned what God had admired in Job. And number two, she unknowingly encouraged what Satan predicted Job would do. How do I know that? Don't you remember what Satan told God Job would do in the very first chapter? He said that, listen, you take away everything he has and he is going to curse you to your face. Wait a minute. That is the very thing she's trying to get Job to do. Satan is now working through her to get to this man. And she is completely oblivious to what's taking place in the heavens. Has no idea. But don't you remember what God said to Satan in chapter 2? After he describes the remarkable character to Job again, he adds this very interesting phrase. I know Satan hated to hear it. And still holds fast his integrity. Wait a minute. That's the very thing she's calling into question, folks. Think about it. She just told him, do you still hold fast your integrity? That's exactly what God said to Satan he did have. It's incredible, folks. You talk about some marvelous lessons that can be learned from this book. She has no idea what is currently at stake. She has no idea that this great contest is taking place in the heavens. She has no idea, folks, that God's reputation is riding on the response of her husband. Has no idea. You and I do, but she doesn't. One writer said this, quote, unknowingly, she put her finger on the single quality in Job's life that God used in answering Satan, his integrity. Her question called into question his need to maintain that any longer. And then she uses Satan's line when she says to her husband, curse God. Satan was never closer to a smile than at that moment. Listen, everything, he says, hung on Job's response to his wife. Everything. And she's completely oblivious to what's taking place. And so how will Job handle this difficult situation? Look at Job 2 and verse 10. Remember, when he said this, his body is covered in boils. Don't forget that. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God and shall we not receive adversity? The Hebrew actually reads this. The good shall we accept from God and the trouble shall we not accept? In other words, God isn't just our God during the good times. He is still our God even when adversity strikes. And he is not to blame over this. God didn't leave us the day we were suffering, in other words. Job's concept at this point in his life about God is right on target. It would later change, but at least at this point, he's got a firm grip on the God of the Bible. Job's thinking at this point was straight. He discerns the error and flat out rejects it. You know, his response to his wife reminds us of Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. Isn't that easy? But watch. But in the day of adversity, consider, God also hath set the one over against the other. They're both part of your life and mine, in other words. Third, when things go from bad to worse, sound theology will keep us strong and stable. I love this point here because remember Alexander White's statement earlier? Job's sorrows came not in a spy, but in battalions. He then adds this statement. He says, quote, listen to this. He says, till Christ came, no soul was ever made such a battleground between heaven and earth as Job's soul was made. In chapter 1, things are bad. In chapter 2, things are worse. And yet this individual still was able to hold on to his thinking correctly. True, he questioned chapter 3. And true, he made some irrational statements, even some brash statements about God. He later would repent of that, to his credit. But at least at this point, his faith was genuine. Number 4, sometimes the one who is suffering can teach the one who is well. Comparatively speaking, Job was suffering much more than his wife was. And yet, in the midst of that profound misery, he's teaching the one who is actually well. That's amazing to me. When Jesus was on the cross, the one in agony was teaching the ones who were well in the sense of physically, their physical condition. Obviously, spiritually they weren't. But he was the one suffering, and yet at that moment emerged 7 of the greatest statements that could ever be spoken from the cross. You see, the one who was suffering was teaching the ones who were well. You know, a person can walk the halls, maybe a hospital burn unit, or they can visit a cancer research facility like St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where they see suffering and pain about as frequent as hearing the ding on the elevator when the up or down arrow is pushed. It just seems to echo all day throughout the hallway. No one who enters those facilities leaves quite the same. Is that true, Barry? No, nobody. I don't care. An atheist can walk into one of those facilities. He's not going to leave quite the same way. You see, the ones who are suffering are teaching the ones who are well. Some of the greatest teachers I've had in life, as far as I know, have never taught a Bible class or preached a sermon, though I've had many that were great. Some of the greatest teachers I've ever come to know in life are individuals whose lives have been marked by adversity. I learn from those folks. Those are the individuals that teach us and give us wisdom and insight into what this life is all about. Think about this. John Eldred's book, Wild at Heart, he states, I don't trust a man who hasn't suffered. One man also said this quote. Listen to what he says. He said, I realize the most valuable counsel I have received in my life has never come from a novice. It comes from those who bore the scars of the crucible. Sound advice comes from veterans of pain. As diamonds are made by pressure and pearls formed by irritation, so greatness is forged by adversity. You see, pain is not only a great teacher for those who experience it, but it's also a great teacher for those who witness it as well. The ones who are suffering sometimes can teach the ones who are well. What a beautiful thought that is. Young people, when you're looking for wisdom, always look for someone who has suffered much, but whose faith has remained unshaken. It's the best advice I could give you. You'll learn a lot from those individuals that you come in contact with. Number 5. In times of great adversity, godly companions are sorely needed. Again, Job's wife becomes the focal point of this issue here. As I mentioned earlier, she said some irrational comments. But you know what, ladies and gentlemen? When she made those comments, she actually, unaware, became the queen on the devil's chessboard, so to speak. He was using her. But even though she made those irrational comments, she still stayed by her husband's side. I know that because at the end of the narrative, God blesses them, the same woman, the same husband, with 10 more children. Job 42:13. She is still standing by her husband's side, the same side that was covered with boils. She hasn't moved at all. Now listen, folks, in a day and age when husbands and wives leave each other for such trivial reasons, Job and his wife have much to teach us. Much, indeed. I think they wouldn't laugh, but I think they would cry listening to some of the trivial reasons as to why husbands and wives leave each other today. They have no idea what adversity is. I can promise you this. You may have gone through certain things that may come close to measuring up to what they've gone through, but you'll never exceed what they went through. Is that right? You won't exceed what this couple went through. I don't care who you are. You see, for Job and his wife, the wedding vows, for better or worse, they were there. For richer or poor, they were there. For sickness and in health, they were there. Brought a whole new meaning to their marriage. You see, God's marriage law bound Job and his wife together just as it binds those who scripturally enter that sacred union today. Matthew 19:6 and Romans 7 and verse 4. In times of great adversity, godly companions are sorely needed. I learned that from this couple. They stay together, even though they went through so much. Number 6. In times of great adversity, caring and sensitive friends are sorely needed as well. You know, much of what is said about Job's three friends is done in a negative light, but a closer look at the text reveals some commendable things about them. Think about this. Number 1, caring and sensitive friends come without first being asked to come. That's a simple point, is it not? They heard about Job's predicament. No one sent an invitation. Folks, you don't need an invitation to come to someone's aid when they're grieving. Nobody ever receives an invitation to come to a funeral. You go because you care. These individuals at least started out great. They heard about his predicament and they simply came. Caring and sensitive friends will do that. Number 2. Friends respond with sympathy and comfort. Verse 11 of Job 2, the latter part. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. True friends try to enter the world in which the individual is enduring at that time. They try to get into that individual's life without announcing the traditional, I know how you feel statement. You know what, folks? I wish that we would eliminate that statement from our vocabulary. I don't care how well intended it is. It doesn't provide the least bit of relief to the person that's going through that difficult situation. It's a lie. No matter how well-intended it is, it's a lie. People grieve differently, even if what precipitated that grief is the same, such as the loss of a loved one. You see, it's very important that we recognize that principle, ladies and gentlemen. Just because someone has been through a similar circumstance doesn't qualify that person to say, listen, I know how you feel. Does he really know how I feel? Does he really know? When my father died, in 2002, in fact, I was scheduled to come here and couldn't come that year, I remember. A lot of people showed up, and there were people who showed up and with good intentions. I lost my dad, I know how you feel. But then there were the folks who just showed up and just said very little, squeezed my hand, and just couldn't say anything and walked away. That brings us to number 3. Listen carefully. Friends understand, so they say very little. You see, in verse 13, they sat down and mourned with him for 7 days without saying a word. Wait a minute. If only they had stayed silent. You see, when they were silent, they were at their best. When they started speaking after that 7-day period, they started fouling things up. That's where they messed up. If they had only remained silent, things would have been great. But they started speaking. Now, folks, it's very important for us to recognize a vital concept here with reference to this principle that we're talking about right here. I like what Warren Wiersbe said about this. He said, quote, the best way to help people who are hurting is just to be with them, saying little or nothing, and letting them know you care. Don't try to explain everything. Explanations never heal a broken heart. Folks, preachers, keep your sermons away from the hospital. They don't need to hear it. They don't need that. Keep it away. No, not you. Keep the clicker away too, whatever that thing is. People on the internet are saying, what is he talking about? Come here so I can show him. No, that's a very serious point here. Warren Wiersbe simply says that, listen, if his friends had listened to him, accepted his feelings, and not argued with him, they would have helped him greatly. But they chose to be prosecuting attorneys. These three men started off so well, but when they spoke, they started fouling things up. I like what one man said. He said this, quote, sufferers attract fixers the way roadkill attracts vultures. How many times have you seen it? You go to a hospital and you're sitting there and you're trying to find words to say, and maybe you don't say anything, and someone comes in bounding in out of nowhere, and they spend 20 minutes of their time explaining why all this has happened to this individual. And the more they talk, the more we wish they were gone, though we don't tell them that. They're not helping out at all. My favorite one is when you're waiting there talking with someone in the hospital and someone comes in and says, "You know what? My uncle had the same thing you had and he lasted for about 6 months." I tell you what, on your way out, why don't you just roll a hand grenade underneath my bed? There are people that do things like that. And you want to just, as Brother Rice said, give him a good Christian kick in the shins. Never forget him saying that one time. Friends, understand and say very, very little. Let me close out this concept here and then we'll stop. Joseph Bailey and his wife Mary Lou lost all three of their children. They lost their first son at 18 days old. They lost their second son at the age of 5 because of leukemia. They lost their third son at the age of 18 years old in a sledding accident. Can you believe that? For the Baileys, a coffin became a regular piece of furniture in their home. Mr. Bailey writes in a very emotional and thought-provoking book, The View from a Hearse, great title for a book, which has been later changed, or now changed, I should say, to The Last Thing We Talk About. Here's what he writes. And by the way, if you're a preacher, you need this book. It will help you, I promise. He writes this, quote, "I was sitting, torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly, and he said things I knew were true. I was unmoved, except I wish he'd go away. He finally did. Another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat beside me for an hour or more, listened when I said something, answered briefly, prayed simply, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hated to see him go." Listen, preacher, friend. Friends have done it right when those in adversity hate to see you go. Friends say very little. They're there, but they say very, very little. We'll stop right here, and I want to pick up with one final point in Job, and then we'll move on to some lessons that we can learn from this subject. Thank you so much.